with the presentation. Are you going to push them forward for me? Or should I try and click into this?
It's on both sides.
On both sides. Okay. All right. Can everybody actually hear me?
You have to use the microphone.
Yeah, well, do you need the microphone, yeah? I can mic as well.
Yeah, take it off.
All right. So, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I very much appreciate the opportunity to come along and, if you might say, meet with such an auspicious crowd, especially when, as Wen has mentioned to you, you don't see any FSA or anything actuarial qualifications coming from myself. I get quite pleased every now and then. A little bit of history on myself in terms of how somebody can progress within financial institutions, work with accountants and actuaries, but never get qualified. I think that, you know, for the younger people here, they're all trying to work out how they can do that without actually getting qualified themselves, and save themselves some time and effort in terms of doing all their exams. So I thought this evening I'd take you on a little bit of a journey. For some of you, it will be before you even went to school. And others of you, I can see on some of the tables first, and we will be going on a similar journey as myself. I like this slide in terms of it's the rapid tiger of change. So this represents the tiger's eyes in Asia, where I spent 25 years. If you might say, I could have chosen the dragon, but I thought the tiger's eyes are actually a little bit more interesting. The one thing that I would say is different from when I've come to Canada to when I was actually in Hong Kong is that life has slowed down, or at least I expected it to slow down a little bit, but the reality of it is that technology keeps on pushing us forward, and it doesn't really give us a bit of a respite. So, in terms of my career, I'd like to put it as it's actually a career of two halves. I spent the first half of my career trying to find out my true calling in life, and I think I've landed in here finally with Manual Life in its nature. It's a search that started when I did pharmacology, study of action of drugs on the body. You might say, how does a pharmacologist become a banker, become a lender, become a borrower, become an arranger, become a pharmaceutical manager, a pulp and paper recycled manager in its nature? It's all because I'm trying to search for something in its nature. And I think ultimately I finally decided that whilst I'm maybe fiscally deranged, actually financially needs to be well put together. So I started my life with Standard Chartered very simply because in my final year at Cambridge, whilst having played for the Cambridge Blues team, I was deselected for the first Lady Blue ever. There has only ever been one Lady Blue, and she had to be in my year. So I played on the reserve side and got really quite disgruntled with the UK, so I decided I wanted to leave. So I went for a company that was going to send me overseas. I didn't know where I was going at the time. I could have gone to Dubai, I could have gone to Africa, India, you name it, and I got sent to Hong Kong. Officially just for 6 months, and I stayed there 26 years. I went through with Standard Chartered. Some of you will see that Standard Chartered is still in the news now. They were basically bankrupt when I joined them. Little did I know in its nature. And we took this forward in terms of being dropped into Hong Kong at a time when it was a very interesting time in the Hong Kong area. I landed on October 1st, 1987, 19 days before Black Monday. You will see the markets have changed, and that was the first real, you might say, crack of the whip of change. The market seesawed at the time, and you'll see that those seesaws have become bigger and bigger as Asia's tigers have grown and started to influence and change the way the trade happens. So I'll take you through a little bit in terms of the banking side in some later slide. But I joined, set up my own company, Surrender Services, in 1991. And joined one of my clients in a pharmaceutical venture in the first instance. We set up a factory to sell generics in the Philippines, And that's where I got exposed to some of the more interesting business practices that go on in Asia at that time, and still, unfortunately, still today. We won't be going down that avenue for discussion. I tried to stay in industries where I personally felt that I could contribute something to the community. So there is actually a little green factor in what I've been doing all along. Generic pharmaceuticals, producing quality goods for the poor in the Philippines and elsewhere around the world. Recycled paper. The first 400% recycled paper, I was the CFO for the NASDAQ listed company. Unfortunately, took them through bankruptcy after the Asian financial crisis. Toro financing. An interesting one in China. You may not realise, but China, obviously, as you might see more topically at the moment, Mr. Trump, I'm trying not to mention, but I can't help but from an infrastructure spend, China was investing massively on its infrastructure. And there was time and time again needing to raise money externally, how to pay for these things. So toll road financing is still a very viable point of view. And I got introduced to the first sort of modeling that I put in place where I first heard this word provision for adverse deviation. And you might say, what on earth can happen on a toll road financing where you need a provision for adverse deviation? Well, I brought in Piers Brinkerhoff to come and do a full survey, put all the things in place, etc. I've got my Excel spreadsheet model going out for 25 years. I sat down with the inflation guys, worked out what rates were going to happen, etc. And then one light spark and I said, hold on a second. There's a truck there, he didn't pay a toll. Oh, look, and there's another one. What's common about all those trucks? Well, actually, they were all the People's Liberation Army. They didn't pay the tolls. So I suddenly realised that when I did the discounted cash flow, I just lost about 25% of the value of the project and had to go back to the drawing table. Iron & Steel was more around the Asian financial crisis. Lots of buildings being built in Thailand needed rebars, etc. When the Asian financial crisis came along, the property markets collapsed and there was a lot of distressed assets on that side. So I became the haircut manager. Fairly slim haircut at the moment. I was able to go and get the banks alternative financing and ask them to take a 30-40% write-off on their principal debt. So you can see, why am I here on valuation systems? What's the reason coming forward? Had a more interesting time in 1999, after having left the Philippines in 24 hours for various reasons I won't go into. I happened to join a business partner of mine. We had an engagement for a year for the mayor of Shenyang. He was one of the forward-looking mayors at that time and wanted to, if you might say, reorganize his state-owned enterprises. What he really was actually looking for was a pension business. So we've got some pension consultants here today. There's definitely a need for pensions in China because we went into factories where there were 26,000 people on the books, but only 5,000 people working. The other 21,000 were all those individuals who were over the age of 65 who retired, who were still receiving a salary from the company. Because there was no concept of a pension in China at that time. Now, in my case, I was able to jump on something new called the internet at the time, find some eager beavers in the US who had some technology that the Chinese were interested in. And we were able to sell 70% of the company to a Taiwanese partner at the time. So I wasn't allowed to talk about this for 10 years, but the reality of it is that we were able to secure the deal. And what ended up happening, that 70% money actually went in and funded the pension fund for the 21,000 employees. Everybody was very happy, and no riots in the street. That wasn't quite the same that happened when they shut down the lead smelter, but that's another story that we can save for another time. So in terms of insurance, I actually stumbled into insurance doing a corporate review on behalf of my good friend, Mr. Dallas Reed, today, the August Chow, who used to be with the OCI in Hong Kong, and we've got a common family. So there's always 6 points of connection in the world, so please don't renew the acquaintance. Winterthur was a Swiss company based in Hong Kong, and it was put together in 1995. I joined them in 2000 after they had very rapid growth, massive growth, I would say, and the directors of that company were on a very unusual incentive scheme. they were going to get a share of the embedded value growth of this company. So I got exposed for the first time in why, when one actuary says the value of the company is this much, and another one says, well, it's going to be this much, and therefore my slice is something. So part of my job was to keep two sparring partners away to make sure that there was a reasonable payment that came in place. And in the process, we also did a structural reorganization of the company. And what would be, if you might say, following on from my previous days with Surrender Services, was do a business case, present it to the board, and then be asked to put it in place. So by default, I was asked to become the chief financial officer, partly to keep Mr. Reed in order in its nature, because he was the financial brains behind the business. Now, it just so happens that Winterthur kept on growing, and I'll take you through a couple of stories around that as well. But the best part of it was a little bit later on in 2007, AXA came along and bought the business. The original capital invested was $300 million Hong Kong dollars. We sold it for $2.4 billion. So it's not a bad return over what was essentially about a 9 to 10 year period. So it's just that insurance does pay in the long run. Now, after that, I actually happened to join AIG, which later, as you might say, was AIA, and originally went down as the Southeast Asian CFO in Singapore. I had a great time down there, went around, did some restructurings for them, but mainly my job was to prepare them for a big financial change. The group was moving into a new general ledger system where we were going to put SAP in place. And we were replacing a system that was 40 years old, which Morris Greenberg was too tight to replace. The reality of it was that I got pulled up to Hong Kong in the early part of 2007 after that, and was made the head controller, put SAP in place for that office, just in time for the global financial crisis in AIG to be taken down. So September, I think it was the 15th or the 16th, I was in the office for 24 hours, not knowing whether the company ever had any money left, and whether or not we'd still be able to pay the employees the next day. Journey fell on from there. I was then made head of business analysis because they find they had no management information. So those people who look at the insurance world today and you look at non-GAAP measures, I'm sorry, I'm one of the people who created some of those non-GAAP measures. As part of going through with AIA, I was leading the memorandum and discussion analysis on the IPO. And to be able to explain the different sizes of the companies, I came up with a term that was put forward called total weighted premium income. Or if you say it quickly, Twippy. So I was actually called Mr. Twippy because when I got onto AXA, who adopted as well Mr. Twippy, in its nature. This particular measure was really being used to as the basis for the relative size of insurance companies. And it became important as a way of conveying the different size to investors as life went along. So after AIA's listing, we raised $20.5 billion to repay the US government most of the money that had been borrowed by AIG. I took a little bit of time off, played a bit of golf, and went and joined AXA to help them through on the financial transformation that they were doing. And this is really where I started to get my fingers dirty with the actuarial world. And we did what we call the Common Actuarial Modeling Platform, where we went through 9 countries and redid all of their models, put them onto a new server farm in Singapore, and really tried to strengthen it. My thanks from AXA was a note from the then chairman of AXA saying, well, John, you've done a great job, but actually you've exposed the rest of the group to weaknesses, etc., which now cost us $300 million. Goodbye. So, thereafter, I had a conversation with somebody else and realised that my life was going through a similar financial transformation. And this is where I am now. We're 3 years in, and the world is moving quite quickly. So that's an introduction in terms of my career very quickly. But technology, when I looked it up in the diary, these are some definitions that are coming across which does, if you might, to try and link my background as a scientist in terms of using technology or scientific knowledge for practical purposes. But the key thing is at the bottom there. Technology has always been given the an emphasis within companies because it's meant to make it better, faster, and more efficient. Or if I'm being perfectly, if I'm going to the core, it's better, faster, cheaper. Everybody wants to save money. So I'm going to take you back now on a little bit of a ride through technology changes and how they've influenced themselves. Today, you all use ATM machines ubiquitously, etc. But I can take you back to a young individual, age 23 in Hong Kong, who just landed, met his first manager, who was one of the few people who had an MBA. At the time, an MBA was not known in 1988. They were very rare people. Today, you see MBAs all over the place in its nature. But the MBAs themselves were the smart people who were looking at ways that technology was going to change. And I got involved in a very interesting project right at the beginning. You may probably don't hear these anymore. So the time and motion studies, a very old hat. But we used to go in, I can see a gentleman here nodding in terms of time and motion studies. Thank you very much, gentleman on the left there, give me a drink. But time and motion studies are all designed to measure how much it actually costs to serve people. And if you look at it today, and you look at technology as it is, that cost has been coming down gradually. But in 1988, I can tell you quite humbly, it cost 100 Hong Kong dollars to serve every customer of Standard Chartered Bank. So, with a little bit of insight and discussions with some very interesting people from NCR in Singapore, who were one of the first to bring ATM machines to the market, we realized that we could reduce this, not by tenfold, but by almost 100-fold. The cost of actually putting an ATM machine in place, allowing people to withdraw money, deposit money, etc., was able to bring that unit price down from not $100, but to $1. And, more importantly, thinking slightly out of the book, we came forward and said, well, the problem is everybody's queuing up in our branches and clogging up. We can't sell them anything. They're just coming in to deposit money and take things away, which you might say is their right as a customer. But we don't want them in our branches. Can you get them away from it? So at the time, we were the first to really put in place, back in 1989, in nature, Pacific Place, which is one of the flagship malls, was going up. And we went to the management team and said, look, can we put some ATM machines in your mall? And they looked at us totally horrified and said, no, nobody's going to want that. It's going to stop them from shopping. And they said, well, you know what? If the cash is close, they'll spend more. And that's exactly what happened. And I think the story goes on from here that ATMs now are not necessarily next to your bank in its nature. They should be on the street. They should be where you need it. It's at your convenience. And little did we know at the time that we actually started a new industry. There are financing leasing companies who buy ATM machines and lease them back to banks to enable them to put things together. So the other thing that then started coming forward is mobile communication. I had to really search quite hard to find some of these pictures. And I can take people back to, did anybody remember the company called Iridium? Yeah, there's a man in the corner, thank you. I need people with age, we're still in the 90s. So Iridium, at the time, back in the early 90s, etc., raised $6 billion on the US stock market to put the first satellite phone companies in place. They put something like 20 odd satellites up in the air and had these phones, which were the size of 1 kilo bricks, etc. They're still actually in business today, but not under the same management. They specialize in satellite phones. So they're great if you're in the middle of the Sahara Desert, you can make a phone call. But that's not where the majority of people live. So their business model changed when GSM phones came in place. And it's the first opportunity where technology, where people started to work together to come up with common languages. And it'll be a little bit of a theme in terms of what's coming forward at the moment. But the GSM technology allowed mobile phones to come together. But why is this important to insurance? In Asia, the vast majority of insurance was sold and still is sold by insurance agents. They would come into my office, they'd occupy the space, and then they'd go away. I never knew where they were. I didn't know what they were doing, where they were. With the mobile phone, I now had the ability to go and track them and keep them up to date, and they could give the sales intelligence back, they could phone the office, give you information, etc. So the mobile phone started the opportunity for mobile sales forces. And this is a story that's going to carry on. Now, there's another little incident that came across, which is very important. Does anybody here remember Premier Deng Xiaoping?
Yes.
No? So, very important, Comrade Deng Xiao was a very important person, not only in mainland China in terms of his positions when he retired in the late 80s, maybe 9, unfortunately after the events of the Tiananmen Square. But he himself was a visionary within the Communist Party. And he's accredited in 1992 of coming up with the phrase that it's good to be rich. And it's the first time in the Communist Party's history that someone has actually made a statement that it's good to be rich. Or it's glorious to be rich, I think is the English. You know, I didn't actually have it written down in terms of what the Chinese is, but I'm not going to try and put it together now. But what this had actually done, I had conversations in 1988-89 in the banking industry saying credit cards will never make money, the Chinese keep on paying their debts off. They don't borrow. We can only make money through charging ridiculous levels of interest rate. But when Deng Xiaoping came along and said it's good to be rich, what he did, and maybe he was trying to do it, whether he was a visionary, he didn't realise that at the time he actually opened up the entrepreneurial spirit. Innocently was always lurking there within the mainland Chinese. What it's opened up is in 1995, there was almost a rush to issue new credit cards. Not only were the loyalty programs being put in place, but the aggregation of credit card issuers started to go berserk. And by the time, when I was in Hong Kong just recently, I checked with somebody, there are something like 7-8 million people in Hong Kong. How many credit cards are there issued by Hong Kong banks? 100 million credit cards for 7 million people. Doesn't make sense, does it? No, because it's not all held by Hong Kong people, are they? No. Some smarty pants from north of the border have come over and got themselves with a Hong Kong credit card so they can pay their insurance premiums. Very happy. And recently, I think August, you can see that the OCI has sort of gone and played. I'll put Union Play out there because they didn't actually exist in 1995. But I got a very nice story from one of my insurance colleagues saying is that the credit card services were being abused by the mainland Chinese coming in, and also the insurance agents were abusing because there's a $5,000 limit on the Union Pay. But somebody was paying, swiping this card 200 times to pay a premium. So where there's a will, there's a way in its nature. And you know, money always finds its way into different areas. So Union Pay has just been banned in Hong Kong for the use of paying with insurance premiums. But believe you me, we'll find another way. So going on in time, the internet bubble, I won't rest on this too long, but with the exception of saying is that when the internet came along, it did two things, really. It was the first time that people could electronically connect to people. And this was important to me. Because actually, I didn't mention that my last job at Standard Chartered in 1991 was the head of electronic banking. Or more importantly, the head of electronic what? People didn't know where it was going to be. I had managers who were very foresightful, who basically just said that no one's going to want to talk to their bank online. In its nature, the technology didn't exist. Well, with the advent of the internet, and lots of people fighting for 56k dial-up connections, etc. All that little coming in place, etc. You've got the internet browser wars. Everybody's trying to get inside someone's consumer house. And from that, you've got the emergence of the online shopping that we see today and things of this nature. But that couldn't happen in 1988. Google had only just been founded. It needed guys like this to try and push things along. But what it did do, it meant that every financial institution was fighting over domain names. Right? And so the domain name wars were going on as people started to try and use the internet for just putting adverts out there. To say, hi, here we are, I'm a bank, you should come and do it, but I can't do anything with it. Until a little bit later on, at the time when August was in charge of the OCI, when I was at Wintertour, we had a company that we put together called Credit Suisse Privilege. It's now called Swiss Privilege because Credit Suisse sold us, but we retained the Swiss title. And we were the first to really use the internet in Hong Kong for putting together a series of online offerings to our customers. So we were the first to really put in place a salaried sales force, which was quite important. And as I look around the room today, there's a lot of young ladies and gentlemen who would be perfect salespeople for the products that I'm looking at. We had young, well-groomed individuals, none of whom had ever sold insurance at all. So we put them on a 12-week training program. I was the CFO and compliance officer. My job was to scare them to death. Take them through all the guidance notes from the OCI, etc. Make sure that they followed their registrations and they're all certified. But what we provided them with was a sales experience that nobody had in Hong Kong at the time. And few actually still have today. Behind this welcome page was an online platform for seeing the investments that people had in their unit-linked insurance. There's a loyalty program which we use for Swiss points, which you could redeem based on kind referrals in its nature to get your Louis Vuitton bag, your Bang & Olufsen television, your big 65-inch screen TVs and things of this nature. And the reality that came across is that this is where you started to see the power of the customer coming back into the insurance world. So much of the agency-driven world was really sell it to my mother, my brother, my brother's brother, my friend, my immediate relationships, etc. Get a commission and move on to the next person. And I hope to God that they never called me in exchange, because that would take me away from selling to my next customer. I was a totally non-customer-centric individual. Now, many agents will tell you that's not the way that they operate, because the successful professional agents do look after their customers. But the vast majority of agents who are given a license to sell, in its nature, don't actually follow those efforts. So we had a very small salary sales force of just 200 people, up against the giants of AIA Prudential with their sales forces of 6,000, 8,000, 10,000 people. So back in 2002, and I'm going to test your memory here, August, we launched a product called Swiss Plus Account. It was the first time, and I think possibly the only time, that an insurance product has been called an account. So I had complaints from the Hong Kong Banking Association, or Hong Kong Association of Banks. You can't call an insurance product account. An account is a banking term. I said, well, there's nothing in the ordinance that says it is. And more importantly, this product was very interesting, because at the time, this was the first time when interest rates really fell. And the savings rate at Hong Kong Bank was down at 25 basis points. Do you know how much money is sitting on savings accounts in Hong Kong? $14 trillion. It's huge. There's more money on deposit than is being lent. It's still a very cash-rich community in its nature. And there's an awful lot of cashback lending going on because, fortunately, in Hong Kong, interest costs are deductible for tax. Even though the tax rate's so low, everybody tries to minimize their tax burden. So what was actually happening, we offered a picture of a young guy dressed with the usual sort of waist straps, etc. offering 3.6%. It has a picture of a really excited price. But we were literally handing out money to people, $6,000, $7,000, to come and talk to us. We give it to you for 3.6% for 3 months, and we did it using our Class A license, which was meant for a 30-year term products in its nature. So needless to say, I get called up with Mr. Reed, by the way, in front of the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance, and say, the banks are not happy with you, and we're not happy with you. So I have to go to a bunch of lawyers and say, you know what, there's nothing in the insurance ordinance that says that an endowment policy has to be for 30 years. We're just using our license in an appropriate manner to offer a short-term incentive to customers. Now, I've been reminded of this recently because the discussion is going on around IFRS 17, the new insurance code. It will penalise us in today's world, but in those worlds, this was okay. It was a loss leader product, and you might say, why would we do this? Well, if you're a little company, and everybody else has cornered the market already, but you know that there's lots of money out there, how can I flush that money out and get people to come to the toilet? I dangle a very big carrot, and it's always money. Money makes money. In the Chinese world, that was really quite an important process. So we limited it, and we made sure that, I wrote a pamphlet specifically, which I gave to the OCI later on, and I was quite pleased to see that the pamphlet was used in their guidance, note 6 for anti money laundering. We were very conscious, as a Swiss company. The pamphlet was very simple. It said, keep winter tour clean. It explained all of the anti-money laundering rules, etc. We limited the product to 1.5 billion Hong Kong dollars per person. You had to have a Hong Kong ID card. And we put in place all the operational rules to make sure that I knew where that money was coming from. And as the CFO, I made sure that every application came across my desk. And I was very pleased that in 2003, when this product came across, we actually became the largest new business issuer in Hong Kong for one quarter. We sold $300 million worth of this product in a very short space of time, and we pulled an awful lot of money, actually not $300 million, sorry, it was $3 billion Hong Kong dollars, bigger product. We pulled a lot of money out from HSBC, from Citibank, and actually, unfortunately, from our parent, Credit Suisse. So you can see the little bad boy of insurance is coming out here at this point in time. But the reality of it is people say, why did you do this? I said, well, when you signed up for a Swiss Plus account, we gave you money for 3 months. No obligations asked. You could roll it over into a normal sort of product. We'd give you a money market fund rate return, maybe about 1%. But we had put in place a CRM technology in advance, a customer relationship management system, that meant that every time a new customer came in, it got allocated. We started looking at the individual in terms of their age, their gender, the background that we collected. So there was very little information that we needed to put into it, but we were checking on age and gender and background. And we matched them with our sales team. So it was a little bit of what it might say, not quite the beginning of Tinder or match in its nature, but we were trying to match, if you might say, successful middle-aged men with young 20 to 28-year-old ladies, and vice versa, in its nature. It worked very well. We had, within the first 3 months, we had a 40% conversion rate. This far exceeds any expectation or spreadsheet that we put together. We were happy if we were going to get 8 or 9. We got 40%. And in Hong Kong, we then were selling Class C unit-linked insurance. The new business margins on Class C unit-linked insurance was around about 30 to 40% at the time. And we ended up taking the $3 billion and we turned it into $300 million worth of new business in its nature. It speared our loyalty program, and when the reason why the winter tour's price had gone up so much is that we built a portfolio of very loyal customers. We were also leading in terms of the platform management, so we now start to see fund of funds being available. You can get a platform with 100 funds. We were the first to break the mould in Hong Kong, where traditionally you bought unit linked to the only three funds: the high risk, the balanced, and the money market fund. We started offering 20, 30 funds, etc. And unfortunately for us, we hit on a bit of a gold mine. We were the first to launch a gold fund when the price of gold was $200 an ounce. You can see how loyal our customers are today in its nature. So the stories that come along costs, it's the opportunity. There's no way we could have done this if we were operating in the UK. The establishment could have shut us down. But in Hong Kong, there was an opportunity to seek out, bring that technology together very quickly, and provide a new customer experience. So another important technology advancement came across later on is on secure transfer protocol. So when the internet was first put together, no one had really thought about sending money across it. The concept of a Bitcoin that you've got today had never even been conceived. So some smart guys at the credit card businesses started working out and said, oh, we can do online payments. PayPal really were the guys who started putting this together, and it's rapidly being followed by many of the credit card companies. The Bank of China at the bottom here, trillions of renminbi now going across all of their credit card systems, except for online payments. Alibaba has grown into an absolutely enormous company on the back of this very simple technology that started to come out in 2005. It's progressed in different generations as it comes along, and you'll start to see that you'll get, rather than having the hypertext transfer piece, the HTTPs that you see on the websites today, you'll see HTTPS coming in place. This is essentially saying it's going through a secure encrypted server somewhere. If you are in the if you look in the credit card world, people who remember 9/11, the Patriot Act, every credit card in its nature goes through a secure server sitting in the United States. So whenever you use your credit card, it's always going to go through the United States, whether it's going through Visa or MasterCard in its nature. So be aware, make sure you're not doing anything inappropriate with your credit card. So as time comes along, and I'm conscious of time as well, the Internet of Things starts to arrive. The first iPad came out in April 2010. I had one. I still actually have the original one. It still works, although it sits a little slow. I've got nearly every... Did you see that? You realise I put a dynamic thing on Apple iWatch? So the elements that come across, smart watches, Fitbits, the new sort of Microsoft Surface, which is a computer and an iPad all combined together. These are wonderful devices for salespeople. It's enabled us to be able to totally mobilize our sales force and now provide them with a client-rich environment where they can actually take money from somebody. They can put a little square on top, take a credit card reading its nature. I still remember promoting insurance in the shopping malls in Hong Kong, having to find a fixed telephone line to plug in my credit card reader, or having to take little swipes off the carbon copies, etc., so you can go manually process the payment for somebody. Today, you can do all this in a lot faster in its nature. So technology really has changed the way that we actually operate from a sales point of view. Now, so something a little bit more interesting. Cloud computing. The guys at Amazon really were the leaders in cloud computing. But I still think, from my point of view, Microsoft Azure has really taken it to a new level by essentially making their technology open source. So one of the problems in the early days of technology is everybody wanted to make money on it, so they go and put their own little stamp on it. Steve Jobs didn't want anybody to do it, so the Apple environment's there. You've got the guys from Sony trying to do theirs, the Android areas that come in place, which are more open source in its nature. So Google's been a big pusher in this area. And then, of course, you've got the IBMs of this world, who used to be the big giants, etc., but in this world, they're the little guys now. that they're starting to wake up to and try and tell everybody that big, but actually they're not really that big. So what has this done in the insurance world? Well, it's made computing available to people who either wanted it or didn't know that they were using it. So if you've got the Apple iPhone today, you've been using cloud computing for years, didn't realise it at the time, didn't care, you just saw it as a service. And what very many people don't realise is that your Apple phone is actually supported by Microsoft. It's not something that they advertise in its nature, but that all of the Apple music and iTunes, etc., are stored on Azure service and work. Amazon has stayed in the B2C world in its nature, so they haven't really penetrated too much into the financial institutions world. They started, they offered graphic processors for computer modelings, etc., but they've just recently dropped out of the business saying, you know, the actuaries do like us, but they're not big enough. The bigger fees, the oceans that we can go and swim in, as you might say. Whereas Microsoft has stayed the course. And I'm pleased to say that Manulife, we've had a very positive relationship with Azure and also our actuarial modeling software provider, GGY. But it's not just, GGY's got their cloud services, we've also got Milliman and all the different prophets got their own, Moses, etc. They've all, if you might say, jumped on the ideas, because what's happened in the insurance world? I was explaining to Fina a little bit earlier, because she's obviously too young to realise where the actuarial modelling world has come from. From the old days when I was in Hong Kong, where everything was 4% of a sum assured, it was a simple calculation, and we've done the valuation straight away. I could do it literally on the back of an envelope. No, not anymore. The world changed really in the 1990s when people started to play and put computers together. It's on the back of these smart guys from CERN who built the internet in the first instance, and the computers started to talk to each other. It's the universities who've been bringing out modeling software that we use today in its nature. It's all been commercialized through the various either accounting firms or other people who've been bought important because they see there's a good business model there, and they've helped advance it. But the reality of it is, in the time when I was having fun with the Swiss Plus account in the early 2000s, there was a fairly serious stock market crash in Europe that caused volatility in the markets in Europe. It subsequently came out and even bigger, if you might say, in 2008. But what's that for is policyholder behaviour changes. Right? So now people start modelling policyholder behaviour. It wasn't regulated at first, but the insurance companies were ahead of the game. The moment they had that capability, the regulators started regulating on it. And next we had Solvency I, or Swiss Solvency ratios, and now Solvency II in Europe. Part of the reason why I was doing my actuarial modelling revamp in Asia for AXA was around Solvency II, giving it such that we could actually do things consistently in its nature. It was a need to be able to explain those results in a very fast and rapid way, but also to give the actuaries the right tools to do more complicated calculations. They needed more computing power. Server farms were there. We have distributed computing being put in place. But with the advent of cloud computing, which really, in my mind, only really came to its fruition in about 3 or 4 years ago, it's now come forward in a massive way. There's been huge investments. And I think Towers Watson recently did a modeling exercise where they linked 100,000 computers together across the world. It's just amazing what could be done. You've got modeling being put in place, not just in the insurance world, but you've got most of your weather predictive tools, etc., coming together. Actually, very interesting companies who we don't like to talk about, but we will just mention them very briefly. Enron. Enron actually was one of the first to really leverage the cloud for their computing, so that they could screw all their investors and run away with money. But it was based on the fact that they were trying to predict the weather. And so some of the technology that they built actually was genuine in its nature, the way they went to market it, maybe not so honest in its nature. But they did actually leave a legacy behind them, and it's helped develop modeling around the world. So from the cloud itself, I see that the technology is really starting to change, and it's helped ourselves at Manulife in terms of evaluation systems. One of the last things I'm going to do is social media. Now, do you all recognise these logos? All of them? Yeah? Facebook? Twitter? Snapchat? I got introduced to Snapchat by my daughter. LinkedIn? WhatsApp? And WeChat. If you walk into a Manulife building at the moment, we've got a nice little picture in all the lifts, etc. We try and bring across all of our customers who come and visit us. It will tell you that in the Manulife Sinochem, on a single day in China, we solved just under 14,000 policies using WeChat. It's amazing. The reach at which these social media apps have come together to provide, if you might, new ways of connecting to your customer, not only for disseminating information from a social media point of view, but also as a distribution channel. Because the youth of today don't buy insurance because their dad told them to. They buy it because their friends have got one. And they all want to have something similar in its nature. Social media is really starting to put together the herd mentality, but you want to be in the right herd, you want to be looking appropriate. So people want to know whether you're buying the latest pair of jeans or shirts, etc., the latest fashion trends, and it's also important you get into insurance. So I'm going to leave the final update that's coming together here. I'm going to challenge some of you. Does anybody know who the little yellow elephant is? So, there was a Google think tank who came up with the idea of linking computers together to break the backbone of the big database companies. So, in the past, databases are in very big boxes, etc., and they scale, but they've got a limit to them. Someone says, I want unlimited storage capacity. I want to copy the whole of the internet, of all of the millions and millions and millions of activity that are going across. I need something that can hold the whole of the internet in it, and it won't ever fit into a single box. So they came up with technology of stringing the boxes together for storage. And they also found a way that when you want to sort it, they put it on a separate box. So they've separated two things which are very important with databases: storage and sorting, compute power, what's called MapR. So they thought, well, hey, you know, pat themselves on the back one day, we invented something new here, what should we call it? So the guy who was the inventor had a six-year-old son who had a little elephant whose nickname was called Hadoop. And that's how Hadoop got its name. It's now sparked on lots of other new areas. I couldn't put enough different ideas on here. You've got Spark, you've got Hive, you've got Pig. All of these different new technologies that go around, pigs go around eating data, hives manage data a lot faster than anything's nature. Spark is a new piece of technology coming in place. SAS is well known for their integrated database management, etc., being used in proper CRM tools, etc. Microsoft has got their machine learning, the man thinking out of his head in the cloud. And the little guy on the end there called Extreme Blue. Do you know who that is? It's IBM trying to get back in the game. Right? Because it's an evening. This is a fun place to be in terms of the technology world. So, to wrap up, because I know people are getting hungry, so am I. To me, technology has enabled insurers to work remotely and more securely. All of these changes in protocols, etc., you get your constant upgrades on your Apple iPhone. You get your new browsers coming in place. It's all around securing your information in its nature. Unfortunately, there's always somebody who's trying to pick your pocket in one form or another. Achieve scale and efficiencies. It's all about being big. Insurance companies are fundamentally based on community lending, if you like, or community insuring, where you pull the risk together. Technology is enabling this to come together in a better way. And more importantly, from my side, as I've always wanted to stay in a, you might say, a green world or a customer-centric world, is that we are now becoming, as insurance companies, more customer-centric. We're reconnecting to our customers who historically we've been trying to avoid. On the understanding, because the new generation of customers would never come to us if we didn't have a social media page, if they couldn't look us up on the internet, if they couldn't share ideas with their friends in intellectual. And this is really what's coming forward. So to me, it's making the information technology moving better, faster, and it's making us more efficient as a whole. So with that, I thought I would say thank you and open up to a few questions if you have any. Would anybody like to ask a question, or is everybody 200? So,
blockchain manufacturers like Manulife is interested in blockchain.
Yes.
Where's that going to go, and what's the application that they're going to put in okay. Blockchain?
So, blockchain, bitcoins in its nature. You would have heard more, maybe in the real world, about bitcoin as being a currency which is based on a blockchain. Blockchain is a lot more than a, if you might say, an internationally free currency is what Bitcoin is trying to do. Blockchain is really essentially how, when you want to share information and pass it along to somebody else, ask yourself a question. I actually looked at a business case for this when I was in Singapore in 2007. I didn't have the technology at the time. How many times do you update your address when you change hats? How many people do you write a letter to? How many banks, how many insurance companies, you know, your loyalty programs and cards, etc.? It's all about you, yeah? Because I put it in the written word, and and now, with all of the regulations coming, I actually have to have a proof of address. When I first came to Canada, I couldn't prove where my address was. No one sent me a statement. Yeah? So I didn't actually exist in terms of the Canadian institution. But blockchain allows you, potentially, to register your personal information in a safe, internationally secure environment, which you can then authorize somebody to go and get. It's a way of disseminating secure information because it's not open to any one government or influence in its nature. But it has the potential to be anything from claims management to sharing of information in its nature. In reality also, it's about trade. If you take yourself back to the early parts of the world, barter trade was what, actually in my early days in Standard Chartered in 1987, I got involved in finance and barter trade. People who were buying cars for tomatoes in its nature. They needed a medium of exchange. The Bitcoin is that international potential medium of exchange that's coming in place. The same comes about in 2004, when XML language was put in place as a standard language for the internet, I solved a big problem for the business of trying to give sales illustrations to my sales agents. But I was too cheap to buy them computers. They all went out and bought Dells and Apples and different things, all had different operating systems. So the only point of commonality was the XML language that I could hand it to. Blockchain has the same concept. It's a common language that's, for which is being securely managed by people who aren't owned by a government. It can be turned into lots of different things. From our side, it could be sharing information on the consumer form. It could be sharing information for hospital records. It could be sharing the payments of histories of individuals, etc. So there's a huge opportunity around blockchain in its nature. It's not yet, if you might say, being opened up to the world in its nature. But I'd say that it's certainly from the insurance company's world, people are extremely interested. Manulife is definitely looking at it. I know every one of my previous insurers are looking at blockchain and how to use it in its nature.
Thank you.
hope that answered your question.
I'm just wondering who's going to put it all together. That's the question.
Well, it could be a guy called John Crabbe, isn't it? So I don't know. But I guarantee to you, if somebody can make money with it, someone's going to bring it together.
I noticed that you joined AIG around 2007.
Yes.
And worked there for a few years. That's must be one of the most interesting periods to be working for AIG.
See that tiger's eyes?
So I do remember that the American government let Lehman Brothers fail, and they bailed out the first three companies. One of them is AIG, then Fannie Mae. I think they got the worst deal because I think they give them over $100 billion and they have to pay high interest on it, 50%. And then they have to issue new shares.
Who got the bad deal?
AIG.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, Citigroup got better deal later, but that was later. What happened to the A-share side of things? When AIG was supposedly short of money, and got a lot of money from the government basically took control of, nothing.
They never really took full control. In Asia in particular,
yeah.
Obviously, US, big country, big important, etc., you think that they're the center of the world. Now, I have 15 regulators to the 15 countries that we operate in Asia. Each one of them felt that they were most important in its nature. So what do? They throw a blanket around all of those assets in its nature. And I can tell you, it was my job. I was in and out of the Office of Commission of Insurance, the Monetary Authority of Singapore, the FSA in Japan, assuring them that we were not giving a single penny of our policyholders' money to those miserable people in the United States. And there's an interesting thing that comes across. I was the head of business analysis. I can still remember going through in December of 2008, Mark Wilson, who's now the group chief officer of Aviva, but he was the CEO of AIA at the time. And it's the first time that, maybe not the last time, it was the first time that Mark also really screamed at me very badly. And he screamed at me badly because I hadn't shown him my presentation before. AIG were a very simple company under Morris Greenberg. They had a budgeting process that called 15-15-15. 15% growth, 15% increase in profit, 15% distribution to the management. It was a very nice formula that came across. But they didn't look at really what was going on in their businesses too closely because they were growing based on premiums. So I introduced the concept at the time of annualizing premiums. Just as the management incentives in 2008 were based on first-year premiums, not annualized first-year premiums. So I just put out a very simple chart in the March, I think, of 2008, explaining what had happened in the 15 countries that after the AIG crisis hit the marketplace. And you could see in those markets, Hong Kong, Singapore, which were international markets in its nature, you could see the annualized new premium go along with this and all of a sudden drop. But the first year premiums were still rolling forward in its nature. So everybody got their bonuses in 2008, everybody feeling happy, etc. And I'm here sitting in March, saying, no, you're going to miss everything because this is where the impact is. But in other markets where AIG's name was not known, in Thailand, it was just going up. They didn't know who AIG was. They didn't know what the relationship was with AIA at all. So Mark Wilson put me to one side and said, I need to understand this better, but don't ever embarrass me again with information I don't already know. So rule number one, always tell the boss. But the interesting part in terms of what actually happened is that the regulators did their job. They essentially went across, and this is where you find out there's massive cost holdings in all companies today. And one of the things that AIG was really good at, and still are, is infrastructure spending. They finance the building of bridges and roads and fleets of ships, etc., all across the world. But what Morris Greenberg did is he put a special purpose vehicle together, and then he gave 5% to the UK, 4% to Hong Kong, 3% to Singapore, etc. So you had around about 80 special purpose vehicles, all of which had mixed money in them. And I had to lead a group of people which were basically ripping these partnerships upon and securing the cash. The other interesting thing that was a part of what caused the fall of AIMG is securities lending. Not a very happy story. 12 people in the UK doing work on behalf of then management, not Morris Greenberg, not there anymore. Taking assets around the world and then lending it to investment bankers. We found out at the time that they'd taken assets out of the Asian portfolios and lent it to somebody in the United States who'd gone and invested it in a supposedly AAA security CDO, which had just gone. So, not me personally, but my colleagues were basically fighting with the US government and says, you need to make my policyholders whole. And before we were able to list AIA, we got the $400 million that they'd taken back into the company to keep it together. The regulators did their job, in its nature, to protect the interests of policyholders. And I think that's probably enough of the story before I get in front of your dinners. Any last question or feeling? I'll be done.
We have more questions after the
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sean. That was informative and a fun presentation. Almost like a throwback Thursday for us as well. So audio and slides will become available on our webpage. If we have more questions, we can always save that towards the end and have John share more stories with us. So let the dinner begin, and do stay after dinner because we will have our prizes coming afterward. You have to be present in order to win, so you gotta stay. All right, enjoy.